Okay, don't skip ahead. I'm going to talk to you about climate change. And I know it can get depressing or infuriating, but our show takes a different approach. It's Laura Lynch, and I'm the host of What on Earth, and we're all about solutions and hope. And I promise, no matter how overwhelming climate change might feel, we're with you on the journey to fix this mess. So listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
It was a big shock because I live nearby and I saw it from my windows. It's horrific.
Russians lay flowers outside a Moscow music hall to mourn victims of Friday's fiery attack, while President Vladimir Putin says he knows who to blame. Welcome to Your World Tonight for Sunday, March 24th. I'm Kimberly Gale. Also on the program, more desperate pleas for humanitarian aid to enter Gaza.
Sometimes I feel like I'm losing adjectives to describe just how horrific the situation is for children.
And later, foreign correspondents in Rome get some fancy new digs, a 16th century palace and former political headquarters of one of Italy's most infamous leaders. Russia is observing a day of mourning, as authorities say more than 130 people died in Friday's gun attack and fire at a Moscow concert hall. Work to identify the bodies continues. A number of people have been arrested, and an ISIS group has claimed responsibility. But as Briar Stewart tells us, the Kremlin is pushing another narrative.
Kirill Smolyaninov took video as the gunmen started to storm the Moscow concert hall Friday evening. Some people fled in a panic, but he filmed four trying to shield themselves by crouching behind a metal pillar. Smolyaninov told CBC News that he then tried to escape. When I was on the escalator, I was actually shot at, he said. The photographer who was at the concert to film the band Picnic kept filming. As he looked down from the second floor, he thought he saw five or six shooters. Russian officials say four were directly involved in the carefully planned attack, which killed more than 135 people. This is a tragedy, Smolyaninov said. People died. They were living, enjoying life. They came to the concert, but instead, this happened. Russian officials say a large number of the victims died after the venue was set on fire and people were trapped underneath a collapsing roof. Russia declared a national day of mourning Sunday, and large crowds laid flowers in a heaping pile outside of the hall.
It was a big shock because I live nearby and I saw it from my windows. It's horrific and a big tragedy.
A branch of ISIS claimed responsibility for the attack. According to an unverified video on Russian state media, one of the four men arrested said he recently returned to Russia from Turkey and was paid $7,000 to go to the concert hall and start shooting. In his address to the nation on the weekend, Putin promised vengeance, but didn't mention ISIS. He pointed toward Ukraine, saying that the four who were arrested were headed there, and preliminary data suggested a window had been prepared to help them cross the border.
Putin, being the talented tactician that he is, he's trying to spin this to his own purposes.
Sergei Rodchenko is a professor at Johns Hopkins Advanced School for International Studies. He says Putin, who came to power at a time when Russia had been rocked by a series of terrorist attacks, has repeatedly vowed to make the country secure. But Putin appeared to disregard an alert from the U.S. earlier this month that warned extremists were planning to target large gatherings in Moscow. Putin publicly said the U.S. was attempting to destabilize Russia.
The Russian government was foolish not to believe those warnings, or perhaps not to take any action to cope with those warnings, and instead, focus all of their attention on coping with political dissidents.
Ukraine has denied being involved. President Volodymyr Zelensky says it's clear that Russia is just looking for someone else to blame. Briar Stewart, CBC News, London.
Meanwhile, in Ukraine, air raid sirens rang out through the night, sending people underground into subway stations in the capital, Kyiv. A series of Russian airstrikes came down on the city and in the western city of Lviv, targeting critical infrastructure. There's little detail on the extent of the damage. Sunday strikes came just 2 days after the largest aerial attack on Ukraine's energy system since the war began, which caused widespread blackouts. Poland's military says a Russian missile also briefly flew through Polish airspace, traveling about 2 kilometers over the country before crossing back into Ukraine. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris says an Israeli ground offensive in Rafah would be a huge mistake. The Biden administration has been urging their Israeli counterparts not to move on the southern Gaza city. Israeli officials say Rafah is Hamas's last remaining stronghold in Gaza. In an interview this morning with ABC News, Harris was asked what the U.S. will do if Israel launches an operation there.
Well, we're going to take it one step at a time, but we've been very clear in terms of our perspective on whether or not that should happen.
Are you ruling out that there would be consequences from the United States?
I am ruling out nothing.
Speaking today from Egypt, the UN Secretary General warned an assault on Rafah would be a humanitarian catastrophe and called for more aid to be allowed into Gaza. Marina von Stackelberg reports.
Inside a packed hospital in Rafah near Gaza's southern border with Egypt, chaos. A toddler is held in someone's arms, their tiny hand wrapped in gauze. Blood beads down their forehead as the child stares blankly at the scene around them. Medics treat several injured patients, including a man unconscious on the floor. The footage was captured by a freelancer in Gaza working for CBC News after an Israeli airstrike on a home just outside of Rafah. Today, another setback in attempts to get supplies into the besieged region. The main provider of humanitarian relief into Gaza, UNRWA, says Israel will now block all of its food convoys from entering northern Gaza. Israel has accused a dozen of UNRWA's employees of taking part in Hamas's October 7th attacks. The UN is investigating, but an interim report has found Israel has not provided more details of its allegations. Catherine Russell, the head of UNICEF, says children are starving to death in Gaza right now.
That should never happen when we have the ability to stop it, when we have trucks waiting to go in there.
Russell says Israel prevents anything from entering Gaza it decides could be used for something other than humanitarian relief.
That would include sometimes things like little scissors that we put into a medical kit, and they say that could be used as a weapon. We're having trouble now getting portable toilets in. We're not allowed to do that for a reason that we can't begin to understand.
Russell says on a good day, about 100 aid trucks get into Gaza. Before the war, it was 5 times that.
Palestinians in Gaza desperately need what has been promised, a flood of aid.
Israel's decision to restrict aid in the north comes just after the head of the UN, Antonio Guterres, met with Egyptian officials pleading for aid into Gaza.
Making that happen takes very practical steps. It requires Israel removing the remaining obstacles and choke points to relief. It requires more crossings and access points.
As aid agencies fight to get food, medicine, and other supplies in Gaza, Canada is still trying to get people out. 3 months ago, Ottawa started a program to help Palestinian Canadians bring their extended family members to safety. Of nearly 1,000 applicants, only 14 have gotten out of Gaza. Immigration Minister Mark Miller says Canada will keep trying.
For all our efforts, we do not control the Rafah gates.
And on the other side of those gates, the devastation continues. More video captured by the CBC's freelancer shows an excavator dig through the rubble of a destroyed building. It then lifts a body, wrapped in a blanket, onto a waiting truck. Marina von Stackelberg, CBC News, Ottawa.
Coming up on the program, we'll have this story.
A good chunk of trees are coming down in Vancouver's Stanley Park. That's upsetting a lot of parkgoers.
160,000 trees is a heck of a lot of trees.
I'm Yvette Brend. I'll tell you why, coming up on Your World Tonight.
Canadian officials are bracing for Donald Trump's possible return to the White House, and that includes preparing to deal with policies that could end up hurting the Canadian economy. Trump is promising new tariffs that could make trade with the U.S. more expensive. Katie Simpson now on what Canada is doing to mitigate that threat.
Canadian music echoed through the hallway of one of the busiest buildings on Capitol Hill, and the smell of French fries for poutine wafted through the air. The commotion drawing dozens of staffers and some of their lawmaker bosses to a Canada awareness event led by Canada's ambassador to the U.S., Kirsten Hillman.
We're trying to sort of flood the hill, if I can be honest about it.
Hillman summoned her most senior diplomats to Washington for dozens of meetings to open lines of communication with members of Congress, including Republicans supporting Donald Trump should he return to the White House. Canada may need those connections to help navigate Trump's unpredictable style of governing, especially in light of his promise to impose a 10% tariff on all goods imported into the U.S.
So we will have a serious conversation with them if they're looking to apply that policy to us. But I think the starting point is that it shouldn't.
Hillman says she believes Canada should be exempt because of the renegotiated North American Free Trade Agreement and has used these meetings to remind lawmakers of the billions of dollars in trade that goes between Canada and the U.S. every day. A message that seems to resonate with some of Trump's allies, including Republican Congressman Bill Huizinga. He says he doesn't see how Canada would be hit by the proposed tariff.
I have a hard time believing that that would be the case, especially when it comes to the trade agreement that he negotiated and led.
But this long-term goodwill mission may end up being complicated by the looming Canadian election, where Trump is already a factor.
Fake news.
Fake news.
The left-wing censorship regime.
Their woke censorship ideology.
The Liberal Party released an online attack ad negatively comparing Trump to conservative leader Pierre Poilievre. Trump is known to be easily offended, and after criticism by Australia's ambassador to the U.S. was brought to his attention, Trump vowed to have him removed from his post.
He won't be there long if that's the case. I don't know much about him. I heard he was a little bit nasty.
Ambassador Hillman says Canadian political criticism of Trump hasn't come up in any of her conversations. And Republicans we spoke with, including Senator Kevin Cramer, also downplayed concern.
I know Donald Trump very well, and he's a very secure man. He's a very confident guy. And he may weigh in on some things, but he doesn't hold long grudges.
Several national polls show Trump is the favorite heading into the November election. And while the renegotiated NAFTA may protect Canada from any new Trump tariffs, that protection may be short-lived, as the deal has to be renewed in 2026. Katie Simpson, CBC News, Washington.
Pakistani policewoman Sherbano Naqvi is being hailed as a national hero after footage of her rescuing a woman from an angry mob went viral. The reason for the mob's rage? They thought the Arabic calligraphy on the woman's clothing were verses from the Quran and accused her of blasphemy. The incident put the use of Pakistan's blasphemy laws back into the spotlight. Human rights activists say the laws are used to target religious minorities or to settle political scores, and with very little evidence. Freelance reporter Abdul Sattar has more from Islamabad.
Komal Rehman's life was turned upside down after her husband Imran was arrested. He was charged with blasphemy.
Somebody used his cell phone to send blasphemous content, and the Federal Investigation Agency arrested him.
Komal's husband is facing a lifetime in prison.
The fact is that a moment somebody is accused of blasphemy, not even formally charged, their lives are in jeopardy.
Zohra Yusuf is a member of the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan.
In Pakistan, blasphemy actually carries the death sentence, but so far no one has been executed by the state. However, over 80 people have been killed as a result of lynchings or people taking the law into their own hands.
There are currently 40 people convicted for blasphemy on death row in Pakistan, according to the United States Commission on International Religious Freedoms. Accusations of blasphemy in Pakistan can lead to mob justice, including attacks on the homes of the accused and even whole neighborhoods.
A Christian Pakistani woman who fears for her life
has found refuge in Canada.
Pakistan's most infamous blasphemy case was that of Christian farm worker Asia Bibi. Her neighbors accused her of insulting Islam's Prophet Muhammad after an argument. She spent nearly a decade in prison before receiving asylum in Canada. Her case led to widespread protests and the assassination of Punjab Governor Salman Taseer and the Minister of Religious Minorities, who both supported Asia Bibi. Yusuf says this culture of fear makes the actions of the lady police officer Sayyada Sheher Banu Naqvi all the more remarkable. Naqvi is being called a hero after she stopped a group of men from attacking a woman wearing a dress with Arabic calligraphy on it. Bystander video shows her calming the crowd and physically escorting the terrified woman through the mob to safety.
She was scared, she was trembling, she thought that she would be killed.
Naqvi says the memory of recent mob violence and vigilante justice triggered by blasphemy accusations made her determined to act.
I jumped in because nobody should be allowed to blotch the image of a country which is trying to revamp itself and move in the right direction.
Last August, mobs attacked Christian communities in eastern Pakistan, setting fire to churches and homes after two Christian men were accused of blasphemy. Analyst Tawseef Ahmed Khan blames the political establishment for encouraging fanatics.
In reality, the Pakistani state uses religious extremism as a tool, and if it wants to create problems for a person, its agents hurl allegations against that person.
For CBC News, I'm Abdul Sattar in Islamabad.
Tens of thousands of trees in one of Canada's most famous parks are being cut down. A moth infestation in Vancouver's Stanley Park has damaged and weakened trees. The park's distinctive rainforest already looks much different. But as Yvette Bren tells us, some say the cull isn't the right move.
A chainsaw chews through a cedar nearly as old as Stanley Park until a massive chunk crashes to the ground that's already punctuated by dozens of stumps. Patty of Vancouver has never seen logging like this in the park.
It's very sad. I've been coming to this park since I was a little girl, and I've never seen anything like this before.
An estimated 160,000 trees are being cut in Stanley Park. Most are smaller western hemlocks, but some are 70 to 80-year-old trees. There hasn't been this many trees down since the windstorm of 2006. The culprit this time, looper moth caterpillars.
It'll be 2 years ago this year. It was a cloud of moths.
Bruce Blackwell of B.A. Blackwell & Associates was contracted to assess the situation with the trees a few years ago.
The first priority is public safety. The second priority is long-term fire hazard buildup.
So, chainsaws have been attacking Vancouver's iconic park for the past few months. They're in a race against bird nesting season. Park Commissioner Tom Digby.
We are the busiest urban park in Canada, the second biggest in North America. 18 million visits a year, you cannot simply have towering logs ready to fall on people in busy, crowded places.
This park is the jewel of Vancouver.
Gillian McGuire is with the Save Stanley Park Society, who have petitioned to save trees and stop traffic in the park. She doesn't think this many trees need to be cut.
I mean, obviously, when we see forests being cut down in our neighborhood, we have an emotional reaction. But we've gone beyond that and looked at the actual science.
She says cutting trees ups fire risk by leaving dead wood and creating fire corridors. UBC Forestry Department head Richard Hamlin says the city made the right move.
Now we're in a city park, and we have to think about safety. We have to think about risk of fire.
Next week, replanting of 25,000 seedlings begins. But for park goers, it will be a long wait.
Hopefully my grandkids and their kids will be able to enjoy what I've been able to enjoy.
for trails to feel like a rainforest again. Yvette Bren, CBC News, Vancouver.
In the heart of Rome, just a short drive from the Colosseum, sits a 16th century palazzo. For more than 20 years, it was the residence of one of Italy's most controversial leaders, billionaire Silvio Berlusconi. By day, he would hold political meetings there, and at night, his notorious bunga bunga parties. Now the palazzo has new tenants, some of Berlusconi's most hated enemies, the foreign press. Megan Williams got a tour of their new office.
The head of Italy's Foreign Press Association, Esma Cacir, shows off the new office for foreign correspondents in Rome. It's a sumptuous palace with soaring ceilings and frescoed walls. A palazzo that for more than two decades, Italy's former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi called home.
Adesso stiamo entrando la stanza dove era camera da letto di Berlusconi.
Okay, so we've just entered into the bedroom of Silvio Berlusconi. The corner room where the former leader slept still has the bulletproof windows he had installed. Low light switches betray where his bed once was. The double-sized canopy once belonged to the Soviet ruler Joseph Stalin, a gift to Berlusconi from his close friend, Russian President Vladimir Putin. These days, Kachur and five other correspondents rush to meet deadlines in the room. She says it's no small triumph. The world's press has taken over Berlusconi's old digs.
Più di 20 anni non veniva a fare la conferenza stampa alla stampa estera. Ci ignorava.
For more than 20 years, Berlusconi refused to give press conferences with foreign journalists, she says. He came once, said the questions were offensive, and never returned. The three-time prime minister also controlled the state broadcaster, while owning most of Italy's private TV stations and papers. Berlusconi's corruption scandals and his bunga bunga sex parties made headlines around the world, presenting him as a particularly Italian phenomenon. And foreign journalists dined out on coverage of him. Now they're dining in the palace's restaurant with sparkling chandeliers.
It was the palace that defined power in Italy for more than 20 years, but it's also for us a way to rewrite that history maybe for the country.
Says Gustav Hofer, a foreign press board member and correspondent for the German-French Arte television. Hofer and others learned the palace was for rent after they got notice that the old foreign press office was being turned into a five-star hotel.
Sottolinea ancora una volta quanto sia decisivo.
Italy's president, Sergio Mattarella, inaugurated the new press office this week, saying a free press is essential to protecting individual liberty and extinguishing the fires of war.
From the heart of Rome, now we can deliver stories and give also this place a different connotation. And I think every place deserves a new start.
Megan Williams, CBC News, Rome.
And that is Your World Tonight for Sunday, March 24th. I'm Kimberly Gale. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.